لبيروت من قلبي سلام لبيروت.
And this is CPRMetro.org, Community Progressive Radio. My name is Bernard White. Since Donald Trump came to office, the drums of war are pounding louder and louder. Today on Wake Up Call, we take a closer look at U.S. involvement in wars, both physically, psychologically, economically. What is the primary objective of the U.S. involvement in dozens of wars? We'll hear from journalist Chris Hedges, human rights leader Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King, and Professor Howard Zinn.
This we turn to Ali Al-Ahmed, director of the Institute for Gulf Affairs. Welcome to the show, Ali. Why do you believe Saudi Arabia is acting with such hostility towards Lebanon at this moment? Particularly, why is the accusation that the country has been, quote, kidnapped by Hezbollah significant?
You know, it is true that Hezbollah is in contact and is helping the Yemenis who are fighting the Saudis. That's not a secret, but in wars, the Yemenis who are fighting the Saudi alliance supported by the United States, the UK, France, and Spain, is have the right and naturally will seek assistance from abroad to defend themselves. So that's not really the issue, because that has been an established fact from the Saudi side for a long time. I think this may have both domestic and external factors. The fact that the Saudis and the Israelis are talking now face to face secretly, yes, but this could be a price that the Saudis are offering as a gift to the Israelis. And we are seeing and hearing about an Israeli-American-Saudi plan to bomb parts of Lebanon, namely Hezbollah targets by Saudi jets supported by the American and the Israelis.
What do you make of Lebanese Prime Minister Saad Hariri's resignation coming while he was in Saudi Arabia, and the fact Hassan Nasrallah, the leader of Hezbollah, says it was not, in fact, their wish for him to go?
It's very clear, all the information that have been gathered and coming out of Riyadh, that Saad al-Hariri is not free. He's not doing this out of his free will. This was an imposed resignation by the Saudis, which is a very, very dangerous step. But they have been able to get away with it by basically kidnapping a sitting prime minister of another country and forcing him to resign, and forcing him and keeping him in detention in the Ritz-Carlton, and deciding what's going to happen in Lebanon. They all the indications says that they will bomb Lebanon flying over Jordan and parts of Syria to bomb parts of Lebanon, and we might see this happening over the next few days.
So you really believe we're on the brink of war at this very moment?
Yes.
Well, what could be the root of this? I mean, the Syrian government is emerging victorious in its battle against foreign, including U.S. and Gulf-backed fighters. How is Hezbollah connected to that development, and how might that be related to Saudi's behavior?
I think the Saudis are frustrated, obviously, with their loss. The battle for Syria has been lost. The battle in Iraq has been lost. So Lebanon is another battle. It's not going to be a battle where the Saudis are trying to change much. This is basically for them to vent their frustration, because they cannot send troops. They can only send jet planes to bomb certain targets and come back. But this will cement the Israeli-American Saudi relations, and I think that is the emerging. If the Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman is trying to create an opening for a relationship between his government and the Israeli state, so in order to achieve that, the population must see Hezbollah, especially, as the enemy. So it will be much easier for the Saudis and Israelis to have an open relationship if there is a conflict, an active conflict between the Saudis and Hezbollah. And that's, I think, is the reason. This is a pretext for an Israeli-Saudi relationship.
Well, the mainstream media is parroting the Saudi ruling family, repeatedly describing the mass arrest carried out by Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman as an anti-corruption purge. Do you believe that's what this is about?
It's not really an anti-corruption, although those people who have been arrested are corrupt. It is part of Mohammed bin Salman's desire to increase his influence and to cement his complete hold on the Saudi state. This was a smart move on his side, because all of these detainees are hated by the population. They are corrupt, and they have taken hundreds of billions of dollars. In this way, he appeases the population, makes them happy. But at the end, he will take that money to carry on his project, either the economic project that he announced or to cement his relationships with the Israelis and the American. He needs money, and the best way to get the money is from these people, because they have lots of it.
We have about a minute left, Ali. You say we're on the brink of war in the Middle East. What players can we be looking to lead with diplomacy and any hope of peace?
I don't see really any calls for calm. You notice the American statements have been avoiding this issue with Lebanon. In fact, I think Nikki Haley today basically said that, oh, this is a very dangerous situation. And she is basically giving credence and endorsing the Saudi plans to bomb. I think this is not an isolated event. The fact that the Saudis said this is a declaration of war, they are planning something. And like I said, according to my information, the Israelis have provided now the corridor through which the Saudi planes will fly to bomb parts of Lebanon.
Ali Al-Ahmed, very concerning points you raised there. We'll have to speak with you in coming days if indeed this plays out as you say. Director of the Institute for Gulf Affairs, thank you so much for your time this afternoon.
Mr. Chairman, friends and brothers in this first gathering of the National Conference on New Politics, ladies and gentlemen, can you hear me in the back? I don't know if the Klan is in here tonight or not with all the trouble we're having with these microphones. And seldom, if ever, we're still working with it. As I was about to say, seldom, if ever, has such a diverse and truly ecumenical gathering convened under the aegis of politics in our nation. And I want to commend the leadership of the National Conference on New Politics for all of the great work that they have done in making this significant convention possible. Indeed, by our very nature, we affirm that something new is taking place on the American political horizon. We have come here from the dusty plantations of the Deep South and the depressing ghettos of the North. We have come from the great universities and the flourishing suburbs. We have come from Appalachian poverty and from conscience-stricken wealth. But we have come. And we have come here because we shared a common concern for the moral health of our nation. We have come because our eyes have seen through the superficial glory and glitter of our society and observed the coming of judgment. Like the prophet of old, we have read the handwriting on the wall. We have seen our nation weighed in the balance of history and found wanting. We have come because we see this as a dark hour in the affairs of men. For most of us, this is a new mood. We are traditionally the idealists. We are the marchers from Mississippi and Selma and Washington who staked our lives on the American dream during the first half of this decade. Many assemble here campaigned assiduously for Lyndon Johnson in 1964. Because we could not stand idly by and watch our nation contaminated by the 18th century policies of Goldwaterism. We were the hardcore activists who were willing to believe that Southerners could be reconstructed in the constitutional image. We were the dreamers of a dream. That dark yesterdays of man's inhumanity to man would soon be transformed into bright tomorrows of justice. Now it is hard to escape the disillusionment of betrayal. Our hopes have been blasted and our dreams have been shattered. The promise of a great society was shipwrecked off the coast of Asia on the dreadful peninsula of Vietnam. The poor black and white, are still perishing on a lonely island of poverty in the midst of a vast ocean of material prosperity. What happens to a dream deferred? It leads to bewildering frustration and corroding bitterness. I came to see this in a personal experience here in Chicago last summer. And all the speaking that I have done in the United States before varied audiences, including some hostile whites, the only time that I have ever been booed was one night in our regular weekly mass meeting by some angry young men of our movement. I went home that night with an ugly feeling. Selfishly, I thought of my sufferings and sacrifices over the last 12 years. Why would they boo one so close to them? But as I lay awake thinking, I finally came to myself. And I could not for the life of me have less in patience and understanding for those young men. For 12 years, I and others like me had held out radiant promises of progress. I had preached to them about my dream. I had lectured to them about the not too distant day when they would have freedom all here now. I had urged them to have faith in America and in white society. Their hopes had soared. They were now booing me because they felt that we were unable to deliver on our promises. They were booing because we had urged them to have faith in people who had too often proved to be unfaithful. They were now hostile because they were watching the dream that they had so readily accepted turn into a frustrating nightmare. This situation is all the more ominous in view of the rising expectations of men the world over. The deep rumblings that we hear today, the rumbling of discontent, is the thunder of disinherited masses rising from dungeons of oppression to the bright hills of freedom. All over the world, like a fever, freedom is spreading in the widest liberation movement in history. The great masses of people are determined to end the exploitation of their races and lands. And in one majestic chorus, they are singing in the words of our freedom song, "Ain't gonna let nobody turn us around." And so the collision course is set. The people cry for freedom, and the Congress attempts to legislate repression. Millions, yes, billions, are appropriated for mass murder. But the most meager pittance of foreign aid for international development is crushed in the surge of reaction. Unemployment rages at a major depression level in the black ghettos. But the bipartisan response is an anti-riot bill rather than a serious poverty program. And The modest proposals for model cities, rent supplement, and rat control, pitiful as they were to begin with, get caught in the maze of congressional inaction. And I submit to you tonight that a Congress that proves to be more anti-Negro than anti-rat needs to be dismissed. It seems that our legislative assemblies have adopted Nero as their patron saint and are bent on fiddling while our cities burn. Even when the people persist and in the face of great obstacles develop indigenous leadership and self-help approaches to their problems, and finally tread the forest of bureaucracy to obtain existing government funds, the corrupt political order seeks to crush even this beginning of hope. The case of CDGM in Mississippi is the most publicized example, but it is a story repeated many times across our nation. Our own experience here in Chicago is especially painfully present. After an enthusiastic approval by HEW's Department of Adult Education, SCLC began an adult literacy project to aid 1,000 young men and women who have been pushed out of overcrowded ghetto schools in obtaining basically literacy skills prerequisite to receiving jobs. We had an agreement with A&P Stores for 750 jobs through SCLC's job program, Operation Breadbasket, and had recruited over 500 pupils the first week. At that point, Congressman Kuchinski and the Daily Machine intervened and demanded that Washington cut off our funds or channel them through the machine control poverty program in Chicago. Now we have no problem with administrative supervision, but we do have a desire to be independent of machine control and the Democratic Party patronage network. For this desire for a politically independent approach to the needs of our brothers, our funds are being stopped as of September 15th, and a very meaningful program discontinued. Yes, the hour is dark. Evil comes forth in the guise of good. It is a time of double talk, when men in high places have a high blood pressure of deceptive rhetoric and an anemia of concrete performance. We cry out against welfare handouts to the poor, but generously approve an oil depletion allowance to make the rich richer. Six Mississippi plantations receive more than $1 million a year not to plant cotton, but no provision is made to feed the tenant farmer who is put out of work by the government subsidy. Crowning achievement in hypocrisy must go to those staunch Republicans and Democrats of the Midwest and West who were given land by our government when they came here as immigrants from Europe. They were given education through the land-grant colleges. They were provided with agricultural agents to keep them abreast of farming trends. They were granted low-interest loans to aid in the mechanization of their farms. And now that they have succeeded in becoming successful, they are paid not to farm. And these are the same people who now say to black people whose ancestors were brought to this country in chains and who were emancipated in 1863 without being given land to cultivate or bread to eat, that they must pull themselves up by their own bootstraps. What they truly advocate is socialism for the rich and capitalism for the poor. I wish that I could say that this is just a passing phase in the cycle of our nation's life. Certainly times of war, times of reaction throughout the society. But I suspect that we are now experiencing the coming to the surface of a triple-pronged sickness that has been lurking within our body politic from its very beginning. That is the sickness of racism, excessive materialism, and militarism. Not only is this our nation's dilemma, it is the plague of Western civilization. As early as 1906, W.E.B. Du Bois prophesied that the problem of the 20th century will be the problem of the color line. Now, as we stand two-thirds into this crucial period of history, we know full well that racism is still that hound of hell which dogs the tracks of our civilization. Ever since the birth of our nation, white America has had a schizophrenic personality on the question of race. She has been torn between selves, a self in which she proudly professed the great principles of democracy, and a self in which she madly practiced the antithesis of democracy. This tragic duality has produced a strange indecisiveness and ambivalence toward the Negro, causing America to take a step backward simultaneously with every step forward on the question of racial justice. To be at once attracted to the Negro and repelled by him, to love and to hate him. And there has never been a solid, unified, and determined thrust to make justice a reality for Afro-Americans. The step backward has a new name today. It is called the white backlash. But the white backlash is nothing new. It is the surfacing of old prejudices, hostilities, and ambivalences that have always been there. It was caused neither by the cry of black power, nor by the unfortunate recent wave of riots in our cities. The white backlash of today is rooted in the same problem that has characterized America ever since the black man landed in chains on the shores of this nation. This does not imply that all white Americans are racist. Far from it. Many white people have, through a deep moral compulsion, fought long and hard for racial justice. Nor does it mean that America has made no progress in her attempt to cure the body politic of the disease of racism. or that the dogma of racism has not been considerably modified in recent years. However, for the good of America, it is necessary to refute the idea that the dominant ideology in our country, even today, is freedom and equality, while racism is just an occasional departure from the norm on the part of a few bigoted extremists. Racism can well be that corrosive evil that will bring down the curtain on Western civilization. Arnold Toynbee has said that some 26 civilizations have risen upon the face of the earth. Almost all of them have descended into the junk heaps of destruction. The decline and fall of these civilizations, according to Toynbee, was not caused by external invasions, but by internal decay. They failed to respond creatively to the challenges impinging upon them. If America does not respond creatively to the challenge to banish racism, some future historian will have to say that a great civilization died because it lacked the soul and commitment to make justice a reality for all men. The second aspect of our afflicted society is extreme materialism. An Asian writer has portrayed our dilemma in candid terms. He says, "You call your 1,000 material devices labor-saving machinery, yet you are forever busy with the multiplying of your machinery. You grow increasingly fatigued, anxious, nervous, dissatisfied. Whatever you have, you want more. And wherever you are, you want to go somewhere else. Your devices are neither time-saving nor soul-saving machinery. There are so many sharp spurs which urge you on to invent more machinery and to do more business. This tells us something about our civilization that cannot be cast aside as a prejudice charge by an Eastern thinker who is jealous of Western prosperity. We cannot escape the indictment. This does not mean that we must turn back the clock of scientific progress. No one can overlook the wonders that science has wrought for our lives. The automobile will not abdicate in favor of the horse and buggy, of the train in favor of the stagecoach, of the tractor in favor of the hand plow, of the scientific method in favor of ignorance and superstition. But our moral lag must be redeemed. When scientific power outruns moral power, we end up with guided missiles and misguided men. When we foolishly maximize the minimum and minimize the maximum, we sign the warrant for our own day of doom. It is this moral lag in our thing-oriented society that blinds us to the human realities around us and encourages us in the greed and exploitation which create the sector of poverty in the midst of wealth. Again, we have deluded ourselves into believing the myth that capitalism grew and prospered out of the Protestant ethic of hard work and sacrifice. The fact is that capitalism was built on the exploitation and suffering of black slaves. And continues to thrive on the exploitation of the poor, both black and white, both here and abroad. If Negroes and poor whites do not participate in the free flow of wealth within our economy, they will forever be poor, giving their energy, their talents, and their limited funds to the consumer market, but reaping few benefits and services in return. The way to end poverty is to end the exploitation of the poor, ensure them a fair share of the government's services and the nation's resources. I proposed recently that a national agency be established to provide employment for everyone needing it. Nothing is more socially inexcusable than unemployment in this age. In the 30s, when the nation was bankrupt, it instituted such an agency, the WPA. In the present conditions of a nation glutted with resources, it is barbarous to condemn people desiring work to soul-sapping inactivity and poverty. And I am convinced that even this one massive act of concern would do more than all the state police and armies of the nation to quell riots and steal hatreds. And the tragedy is that our materialistic culture does not possess the statesmanship necessary to do it. Victor Hugo could have been thinking of 20th century America when he wrote, "There's always more misery among the lower classes than there is humanity in the higher classes." The time has come for America to face the inevitable choice between materialism and humanism. We must devote at least as much to our children's education and the health of the poor as we do to the care of our automobiles and the building of beautiful, impressive hotels. We must also realize that the problems of racial injustice and economic injustice cannot be solved without a radical redistribution of political and economic power. We must further recognize that the ghetto is a domestic colony. Black people must develop programs that will aid in the transfer of power and wealth into the hands of residents of the ghetto so that they may, in reality, control their own destinies. This is the meaning of new politics. People of goodwill in the larger community must support the black man in this effort. The final phase of our national sickness is the disease of militarism. Nothing more clearly demonstrates our nation's abuse of military power than our tragic adventure in Vietnam. This war has played havoc with the destiny of the entire world. It has torn up the Geneva Agreement. It has seriously impaired the United Nations. It has exacerbated the hatred between continents and, worse still, between races. It has frustrated our development of home at home, telling our own underprivileged citizens that we place insatiable military demands above their most critical needs. It has greatly contributed to the forces of reaction in America and strengthened the military-industrial complex. And it has practically destroyed Vietnam and left thousands of American and Vietnamese youth maimed and mutilated, and expose the whole world to the risk of nuclear warfare. Above all, The war in Vietnam has revealed what Senator Fulbright calls our nation's arrogance of power. We are arrogant in professing to be concerned about the freedom of foreign nations while not setting our own house in order. Many of our senators and congressmen vote joyously to appropriate billions of dollars for the war in Vietnam. And many of these same senators and congressmen vote loudly against a fair housing bill to make it possible for a Negro veteran of Vietnam to purchase a decent home. We arm Negro soldiers to kill on foreign battlefields, but offer little protection for their relatives from beatings and killings in our own South. We are willing to make the Negro 100% of a citizen in warfare, but reduce him to 50% of a citizen on American soil. No war in our nation's history has ever been so violative of our conscience, our national interests, and so destructive of our moral standing before the world. No enemy has ever been able to cause such damage to us as we inflict upon ourselves. The inexorable decay of our urban centers has flared into terrifying domestic conflict as the pursuit of foreign war absorbs our wealth and energy. Squalor and poverty scar our cities as our military might destroys cities in a far-off land to support oligarchy to intervene in domestic conflict. The president who cherishes consensus for peace has intensified the war. In answer to a cry to stop the war, it has brought tauntingly to 1 minute's flying time from China to a moment before the midnight of world conflagration. We are offered a tax for war instead of a plan for peace. Men of reason should no longer debate the merits of war or means of financing war. They should end the war and restore sanity and humanity to American policy. And if the will of the people continues to be unheeded, all men of goodwill must create a situation in which the 1967-68 elections are made a referendum on the war. The American people must have an opportunity to vote into oblivion those who cannot detach themselves from militarism. And those who lead us, and so we are here because we believe, we hope, we pray that something new might emerge in the political life of this nation, which will produce a new man, new structures and institutions, and a new life for mankind. I am convinced that this new life will not emerge until our nation undergoes a radical revolution of values. When machines and computers, profit motives and property rights are considered more important than people, the giant triplets of racism, economic exploitation and militarism are incapable of being conquered. A civilization can flounder as readily in the face of moral bankruptcy as it can through financial bankruptcy. A true revolution of values will soon cause us to question the fairness and justice of many of our past and present policies. We are called to play the Good Samaritans on life's roadside, but that will only be an initial act. One day the whole Jericho Road must be transformed so that men and women will not be beaten and robbed as they make that journey through life. True compassion is more than flinging a coin to a beggar. It understands that an edifice which produces beggars needs restructuring. A true revolution of values will soon look uneasily on the glaring contrast of poverty and wealth. With righteous indignation, it will look at thousands of working people displaced from their jobs with reduced income as a result of automation, while the profits of the employers remain intact, and say, "This is not just." It will look across the oceans and see individual capitalists of the West investing huge sums of money in Asia and Africa only to take the profits out with no concern for the social betterment of the countries and say, "This is not just." It will look at our alliance with the landed gentry of Latin America and say, "This is not just." A true revolution of values will lay hands on the world order and say of war, "This way of settling differences is not just. This business of burning human beings with napalm, of filling our nation's homes with orphans and widows, of injecting poisonous drugs of hate into the veins of peoples normally humane, of sending men home from dark and bloody battlefields physically handicapped and psychologically deranged, cannot be reconciled with wisdom, justice, and love. A nation that continues year after year to spend more money on military defense than on programs of social uplift is approaching spiritual death." So what we must all see is that these are revolutionary times. All over the globe, men are revolting against old systems of exploitation. And out of the wounds of a frail world, new systems and of justice and equality are being born. The shirtless and barefoot people of the earth are rising up as never before. The people who sat in darkness have seen a great light. We in the West must support these revolutions. It is a sad fact that because of comfort, complacency, a morbid fear of communism, and our proneness to adjust to injustice, the Western nations that initiated so much of the revolutionary spirit of the modern world have now become the arch anti-revolutionaries. This has driven many to feel that only Marxism has the revolutionary spirit. Communism is a judgment. And in a sense, communism is a judgment of our failure to make democracy real and to follow through on the revolutions that we initiated. Our only hope today lies in our ability to recapture the revolutionary spirit and go out into a sometimes hostile world declaring eternal opposition to poverty, racism, and militarism. With this powerful commitment, we shall boldly challenge the status quo and unjust mores, and thereby speed the day when every valley shall be exalted, and every mountain and hill shall be made low, and the crooked places shall be made straight, and the rough places plain. May I say in conclusion that there is a need now more than ever before for men and women in our nation to be creatively maladjusted. Yeah. Mr. Davis said, and I say to you that I choose to be among the maladjusted. As my good friend Bill Coffin said, there are those who have criticized me and many of you for taking a stand against the war in Vietnam and for seeking to say to the nation that the issues of civil rights cannot be separated from the issues of peace. I want to say to you tonight that I intend to keep these issues mixed because they are mixed. Somewhere we must see that justice is indivisible. Injustice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere. And I have fought now too long and too hard against segregated public accommodations to end up at this point in my life segregating my moral concern. And so let us stand in this convention knowing that on some positions, cowardice asks the question, is it safe? Expediency asks the question, is it politic? Vanity asks the question, is it popular? But conscience asks the question, is it right? And on some positions, it is necessary for the moral individual to take a stand that is neither safe, not politic, not popular, but he must do it because it is right. And we say to our nation tonight, we say to our government, we even say to our FBI, we will not be harassed. We will not make a butchery of our conscience. We will not be intimidated, and we will be heard.
It's about three holy wars. That's my sort of in my title, in my head. That's my title of this talk. Although it's not a very formal talk, but three holy wars. What does that mean? I'm not talking about religious wars. I'm talking about the three wars in American history that are sacrosanct. The three wars that you cannot say anything bad about. The Revolutionary War, the Civil War, World War II. Ever hear anybody say anything bad about the Founding Fathers? About the Civil War? About the Good War, World War? No, it's very, very, very hard in our culture to be critical in any way of these wars. Oh, you can be critical of other wars. And there's sort of an acceptance of the fact, oh, this was a bad one. This was a bad one. But no. The Revolutionary War, the Civil War. So I thought, yeah. I thought it's very important to look very critically and carefully at these three idealized wars. I guess the word idealized gives me away. three romanticized wars. Important to be willing to at least raise the question. It's not that I'm going to immediately denounce these three wars. Well, maybe. No, but, well, I don't know how to characterize what I will say about them. But I think it is important at least to raise the possibility that you can criticize something which everybody has accepted as uncriticizable. I mean, that's what we're supposed to be thinking people. We're supposed to be able to question anything. I just heard Barbara Ehrenreich question God, and I didn't hear an answer. I'd like to hear an interview between them, which Matt can publish in the Progressive. If we're thinking human beings, we have to be willing to question everything, including these wars, which nobody wants to say anything bad about. And so that's what I'm going to just start to do, because it's a very big topic, and I only have a little bit of time, and I've been warned about time. They have a guy here who warns you, and he's a very tough-looking guy. And he warns you about time. So I only have a bit of time, just enough to introduce a few ideas, just to think about, okay? One of those ideas is actually something. Matt mentioned Irwin Noel. And I don't know how many of you knew him or read The Progressive when Irwin Noel was editor of The Progressive. But yeah, I met Irwin Noel. And one of the first things that happened when I met Irwin Noel is that we both found that we both had exactly the same idea about a certain thing. That is, we were both making the distinction between a just cause and a just war. That is, there are things that happen in the world that are bad and that you want to do something about. And so you have a just cause there. But our culture is so war-prone that we immediately rush and make this logical jump from, oh, this is a good cause, therefore it deserves a war. No. You have to be very, very careful in making that jump from, oh, this is a good cause, to, oh, therefore we have to make war to do something about it. No. You might say it was a good cause to get Spain out of Cuba in 1898. Spain was oppressing Cuba. But did that necessarily mean, therefore, we had to go to war against Spain? You have to examine that war very carefully to see what it produced. You know, you have to see, and you have to then understand that we got Spain out of oppressing Cuba and got ourselves in to oppress Cuba. So, very careful. You might say that stopping North Korea from invading South Korea was, there's a just cause there. They shouldn't do that. It's not good. It's not right. Does that mean, therefore, we should go to war to stop it? Especially if that war, and you know, the Korean War is one of the least known wars. It's sort of a war that's been lost in history. 2 to 3 million Koreans died in that war. Well, cause, a just cause. North Korea should not invade South Korea. So we go, what's the answer? War. What's the result? 2 to 3 million. million Koreans dead? And is there any particular change in the alignment of South Korea and North Korea? No, it starts off with a dictatorship in South Korea and a dictatorship in North Korea. And it ends up, after 2 million dead, with a dictatorship in South Korea and a dictatorship in North Korea. I'd be very careful about rushing from one thing to another, from just cause to just war. And Erwin Noll is the only other person I found who was thinking exactly along the same lines. I'm always looking for somebody who's thinking along the same lines as me. That's what I do. I go around looking for people. I'm very gratified when I find somebody. The American Revolution, independence from England, a just cause. Yeah. Why should a group of colonists here be occupied by, yeah, they were occupying us, they were, yeah, oppressing us, therefore we go to war, the Revolutionary War. How many people die in the Revolutionary War? Nobody knows exactly. By the way, you'll find out when you look at the statistics of war dead that nobody ever knows exactly how many people die. Who cares? But 25,000 to 50,000 people die. Let's take the lower figure. 25,000 die in the Revolutionary War in a population of 3 million. That would be equivalent today to 2.5 million people dying in a war to get England off our backs. Well, you might consider that worth it, or you might not. Canada is independent of England. Aren't they? I think so. Not a bad society. They have good health care. They have a lot of things we don't have. They didn't fight a bloody Revolutionary War. Why do we assume that you had to fight a bloody Revolutionary War to get rid of England? Do you know that? I always start off saying, do you know? Because I figure people don't know this and they'll be gratified that I'm telling them this. That in the year before the first shots were fired, those famous shots, you know, the shot that was heard around the world, you know, Lexington, Concord, April of 1775, the beginning of the Revolutionary War, that the year before that, farmers in western Massachusetts had driven the British government out of most of western Massachusetts without firing a shot. They had assembled by the thousands and thousands around courthouses, around official offices, and they'd just taken over and they said goodbye to the British officials. It was a nonviolent revolution that took place. But then came Lexington and Concord, and the revolution became violent, and then the revolution was taken over, not by the farmers, taken over by the founding fathers. Farmers were rather poor. The founding fathers were rather rich. The Revolutionary War is not as simple as it first seems, you know. Oh, independence from England. Good. Not that simple. Who actually gained from that victory over England? There were people who gained, no question about that. But it's very important to ask, especially if you're considering a war or evaluating a war, who gained what? And differentiate among the different parts of the population about who benefited from a certain policy. That's one thing we're not accustomed to in this country, because we don't think in class terms. We think, oh, we all have the same interest. We all have the same interest, independence from England. We did not have all the same interest. Do you think the Indians cared about independence from England? No. In fact, the Indians were unhappy that we won independence from England, because England had set a line, the Proclamation of 1763, had set a line and said, you can't go westward into Indian territory beyond this line. They didn't do it because they loved the Indians. They didn't want trouble, right? When Britain was defeated in the Revolutionary War, that line was eliminated. And now the way was open for the colonists to move westward across the continent, which they did for the next 100 years, committing massacres and making sure that they destroyed Indian civilization. So you're going to say, you know, when you look at the American Revolution, hey, there's a fact that you have to take into consideration. Indians, no, didn't benefit. Did blacks benefit from the revolution? Slavery was there before, slavery was there after. No, we remained a slave society after the revolution. Not only that, we wrote slavery into the Constitution. We legitimized it. What about class divisions? Why do we assume, well, aside from blacks and slaves and Indians, what about just ordinary, let's say, white farmers? Did they have the same interest in the revolution as a John Hancock or Gouverneur Morris or Rich or Madison or Jefferson or the slave owners or the bondholders? Not really. It was not all the common people getting together to fight against England. Washington had a very hard time assembling an army. They've got an army. They promised people, they took poor guys and promised them land. They browbeat people. And of course, they inspired people. Well, let's have the Declaration of Independence. Wow, this is what we're fighting for. It's always good, if you want to get people to go to war, to give them a good document and have good words in life and liberty and the pursuit of happiness. Yeah, that's what we're fighting for. Of course, when they write the Constitution, it's not life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. When they write the Constitution, it's life, liberty, and property. Have you noticed that difference? You should take notice of these little things. There were class divisions. When you assess and evaluate a war, when you assess and evaluate any policy, you have to ask who gets what. out of this policy, it's not, oh, the same for all of us. Oh, we're going to raise taxes. On whom? On which part of the population? We're going to spend money. On whom? And what about the revolution? Is there a class division there in the benefits of the revolution? And oh, yes. We were a class society from the beginning. American society started off as a society of rich and poor, of people with enormous grants of land and people with no land. And there were riots. There were bread riots in Boston and flour riots. And there were rebellions all over the colonies of poor against rich, of tenants breaking into jails to release people who were imprisoned there for non-payment of debt. There was class conflict. We try to pretend in this country we're all one big happy family. We're not. And so when you look at the American Revolution, you have to look at it in terms of class. Do you know that in the, again, my air of superiority, did you know what I know? Well, I know you know things that I don't know, but I may as well take advantage of what I know to lord it over everybody else. Do you know that there were mutinies in the Revolutionary Army by the privates against the officers? I ask you, do you know? Because when I studied the American Revolution, when I studied American history, and I'm talking about not just in elementary school, I went to graduate school. I want you to know that. I got a PhD in history. Really? Did I ever learn in my whole undergraduate, graduate education, did I ever learn about mutinies in the Revolutionary Army? No. Well, there's a lot I didn't learn. When I got out of school, I began to learn things. That's when you begin to learn, right? You go to the library. There's nothing like a library. And there were mutinies of ordinary soldiers who saw the way the officers were treated. The officers were getting fine clothes and good food and high pay, and the privates were, well, you saw the Valley Forge and the no shoes and the bad clothes, and they weren't getting paid. They mutinied, thousands of them, and not just five or ten, thousands of soldiers mutinied. So many, the mutiny in the Pennsylvania line, as it was called, George Washington worried about this. It was too much to handle. He couldn't put this down. So he made compromises with them. But later, when there was a smaller mutiny in the New Jersey line, not with thousands, but maybe with hundreds, Washington said, execute the leaders. And they took out a number of the mutineers, and they were executed by their fellow mutineers by order of the officers. I tell you this just to indicate that the American Revolution was not a simple affair of all of us against all of them, and not everybody thought that they would benefit from the revolution. And sure, it was a benefit to be freed from England, but in proportion to population, 2.5 million people die, right? When considering war, the human cost needs to be measured and against what you gain from war. And on both sides of that ledger, problems arise because when you think about the human cost, generally it's an abstraction. Oh, so many and so many people died. It's a number. You give it a number. World War II, 400,000 died. Civil War, 600,000. The World War II, 50 million people died in World War II. Yeah. But it becomes, what does that mean in human terms? So the tendency is on that side of the ledger, if you really want to have an accurate assessment of weighing the cost against the benefits, you have to look at that cost not as an abstraction, not as a statistic, but you have to look at it in terms of every human being who died and every human being who lost a limb and every human being who came out blind and every human being who came out mentally damaged. You have to put all of that together when you are assessing that side of the ledger, the cost of the war, before you ask the question, well, was it worth it? Was it a just war? You have to get that side of the ledger right. One of the things that, great things that Drew Gilpin Faust did, I don't know if you know about her book, the book she wrote about the Civil War. It's a wonderful book. Great thing about her book is she brings home in very explicit, very human terms what happens to human beings in that war. The Civil War was an ugly, brutal war of amputation after amputation after amputation done out in the field without anesthetics, So you have to have a careful assessment of that. And then on the other side, okay, this is the cost. Now you know the real cost, the real human cost. And on the side of gain, you have to ask the question I asked about the Revolutionary War. Who gained and who didn't? And what were the class divisions? And what did this class gain and what did that class gain? I'm looking to see if this guy is following me. If you see somebody creeping up behind me, let me know. In the Civil War, Again, we learn about the Civil War, North versus South, the blue versus the gray, battles, Antietam and Gettysburg. Hey, who in the North? Who in the South? What divisions were there? Well, it was a war to free the slaves. But also, there was a class element to it, in that poor white people were conscripted into a war which didn't have much meaning for them, and where they were being drafted, and where the rich could get out of the draft by paying $300. And so there were riots. Probably a lot of you have heard about the draft riots that took place in New York and other cities during the Civil War. Yeah. There was class conflict in the North. There were some people in the North who got rich during the war. There were fortunes made. J.P. Morgan made a fortune during the Civil War. And that's what wars do. They make some people very rich. And the poor go to fight in the war. Okay, I agree. I mustn't ignore the positive side. And I'm going to come back to that about, emancipation. Freeing the slaves. That's no small matter. That's a big thing on that side of the ledger. But let's say one more thing about class conflict in the Confederacy. There was class conflict in the Confederacy. Most whites were not slave owners. Maybe one out of six whites was a slave owner. Whites were not slave owners. Whites were poor jokers fighting in this war for what? And dying at a much higher rate than the soldiers of the North. I mean, the Confederate losses were greater proportionately than the losses in the North. And as the mayhem went on, as the bloodshed magnified, their families back home were starving because the plantation owners were growing cotton instead of food. And so the wives and the daughters and the girlfriends and the sisters, and they began to riot. They rioted in Georgia and Alabama. They rioted in protest against the fact that their sons and husbands were dying at the front while the plantation owners were getting rich. Huge desertions in the Confederate Army. This class thing had to be examined. But let me come back to the great positive thing that happened out of the Civil War. The emancipation of the slaves. Except that it was not totally an emancipation. Yes, in a certain sense it was, in another sense it wasn't. Now that's important, because if you're going to lose 600,000 dead in the Civil War, which is equivalent proportion of population to 5 million dead today, imagine a war in which we wage on our soil, state against state, in which 5 million people die. Well, maybe it's worth it if you really result, the result is to free 4 million black people, bring them into freedom. Well, they weren't exactly brought into freedom. They were brought into semi-slavery. They were betrayed by the politicians and the financiers of the North. They were given promises and promises. But sure, they were no longer technically slaves, but they were left without resources. They were really left at the mercy of the same plantation owners who had owned them as slaves, and now they were serfs, now they were tenant farmers. Now they couldn't move from one place to another. They were hemmed in by all sorts of restrictions, and many of them were put in jail on false charges. They had vagrancy statutes were passed so that employers could pick up blacks off the street and force them to work, kind of slave labor. I say all this just to indicate that, well, that business of, well, it may have been okay for 600,000 people to die because we ended slavery. Not quite. It's possible that slavery could have been ended another way without 600,000 dead. That's something we don't think of. Just like we don't think of, could we have won independence from England without a bloody war? The thing about bloody wars, the thing about winning something with violence, is that that is controlled from the top. It's not a people's war. Neither the Civil War nor the Revolution War, not a people's war. There are people at the top. They're the ones who gain the most, you know, out of this situation. And so you have to ask the question, yes, could slavery have been ended another way? There are other countries in the Western Hemisphere that ended slavery without a bloody civil war. Still have a green light. Because, you know, I was wondering if I'd be able to get to World War II. which I volunteered to be in. Maybe you know that. Maybe you know my whole history. Maybe you know more about me than I do. But yeah, I volunteered for the Air Force in World War II and flew bombing missions over Europe. I did it because it was the good war. It was the right war. It was a just war. It was, well, after I got out of the war, I began to think sometimes and research and so on and go back over things and learn about Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Because when the bomb was dropped on Hiroshima and I had just finished my missions in Europe and was going to go to the Pacific to continue dropping bombs, and a bomb was dropped on Hiroshima and the war ended soon after, wow, that's great. I welcomed it. Did I really know what happened when that bomb was dropped on Hiroshima? Did I know what happened to those people? Did I have any idea what that meant to those hundreds of thousands of people, of men, women, and children? No, I did not. When I began to think about that, and then began to think about the people under my bombs, whom I hadn't thought about, I never saw them. Flying 30,000 feet, you don't see anybody. Just drop bombs. You know, warfare today is a very antiseptic thing. You know, people blithely, they send predator missiles, even, well, without any pilots at all, right? You know, that's easy. We'll just kill people, and we won't even take any chances of having anybody shut down. 3 months before Nagasaki, we sent planes over Tokyo to firebomb Tokyo, and 100,000 people were killed in one night in the bombing of Tokyo. I mean, later when I visited Japan and I talked to people there, and later when I visited Hiroshima and I met with people who were survivors of Hiroshima, and you should have seen them, or people without legs and arms and blind and so on. When I began to see what that, meant, that war, the 50 million dead in the war, and Well, you say, well, we defeated fascism. Did we? Did we, really? That's another thing, you know. See, it's fine that a Revolutionary War, well, not everything turned out well after the Revolutionary War. Not everything turned out really that great after, and certainly not to warrant that many people killed. And what about World War II? 50 million people dead, and, oh, sure, you got rid of Hitler, you got rid of the Japanese military machine and Mussolini, but did you get rid of fascism in the world? Did you get rid of militarism? Did you get rid of racism? Did you get rid of war? We've had war after war after war. What did those 50 million people die for? We have to rethink this question of war and come to the conclusion. I think the guy who's monitoring this has fallen asleep. And believe me, I am not going to wake him. We have to come to the conclusion, as I have, war cannot be accepted, no matter what. War.
you know, no matter what the reasons given, the excuse given, liberty, democracy, this, that, you know, no, war is by definition the indiscriminate killing of huge numbers of people for ends which are uncertain. If you think about means and ends, you think about that ethical proposition and apply it to war, the means are horrible, certainly. The end is uncertain. That alone should make you hesitate. And then, of course, people always ask the question, this question has always been asked of me, and so I'm going to preempt your asking it, even in your head. Yeah, but what else were we to do? This is what people ask. What else are we to do about this, about that, about independence from England, about slavery? And yeah. By the way, an interesting thing about slavery, John Brown wanted to free the slaves. This is a year before the Civil War, right? He tries to start, wasn't very good at it, but he tried to start a slave insurrection, hoping that would, you know, it would spread and spread and spread. Maybe they'd end slavery that way. He's executed by the government of the United States and the state of Virginia for using such violence. The next year, they start a war which ends up with 600,000 dead, and everybody is celebrating that slavery is ended in that way. You see. Well. Well, yeah, just one point I want to make. This is a question that says, what else would you do? And they say, what else? Yeah, but Hitler, you had to do something. Something about Hitler. I agree, you had to do something about all these things. You had to do something about winning independence if you're oppressed. You have to do something about slavery if there's slavery. You have to do something about fascism. You have to do something about all these things. But you don't have to do war. Yeah. You have to, if we have any brains, I don't know if we do, but we're supposed to be smart. We are smart in so many ways. Surely we should be able to understand that in between war and passivity, there are 1,000 possibilities. You see. And but it's curious that once a historical event has taken place a certain way, that is, once history has played itself out in a certain way, you know, oh, Hitler invades Czechoslovakia, Poland, we go to war, war lasts a number of years, the war is over. Once it has played out in a certain way, fascism is over. Once it's played out that way, it becomes very hard to imagine that you could have achieved that result some other way. You know, it's because when something has happened in history, it takes on a certain air of inevitability. This is the only way it could have happened. No. No. And you see so many instances in history where things, surprising things take place that you wouldn't have imagined. I mean, if the African National Congress had decided on a bloody war of rebellion against the apartheid system, well, that might be justified. End apartheid? Yes. There would be a war. They'd end apartheid. Maybe 1 million people would be killed, mostly black people. And if it happened that way, then you would say, well, I guess it was the only way it could have been done. Apartheid ended. Because the African National Congress decided, no, we don't want that. We're going to do it another way. We're not going to be passive. We're going to fight back in various ways. We're going to have strikes. We're going to have all sorts of things. We're going to have economic pressure. We're going to do all sorts of things to bring down this regime little by little, to erode its power. Yeah, but we're not going to have a bloody war in which we are going to be the victims, mostly.
There's a fountain of hope water for each of us.
Well, we've come to the end of Wake Up Call for today. Don't move your radio coordinates. There's a lot more good programming coming your way. My name is Bernard White. This has been Wake Up Call. And as always, stay strong, pay close attention, and never give up.
And flower the trees. There are voices of people who need this place. Here, but there's heaven and sunshine.